ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday the 18th of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, paying up. Uber to spend hundreds of millions compensating Australian taxi and hire car drivers for lost income in the 10 years since the rideshare giant arrived on our shores. And sidelined and silenced, victims of crime in Victoria say they'd be unwilling to speak up again after their experience of the justice system. A new report says it's time for a fresh approach.
Why would you put yourself through even more stress? You should be supported through that system, not made to feel like, I don't think I can do this. The system is unbalanced, and I think we need to level the ledger.
First today, a South Australian inquiry into the removal of First Nations children has unearthed horror stories of newborns taken from their mothers in hospital. In many cases, the women had no idea their babies were about to be claimed by the Department for Child Protection. Some returned to their hospital rooms to discover a letter on the bed saying their child was gone. Angus Randall reports, and a warning, this story contains details some might find distressing.
Senior Kaurna woman Mitzi Nam spent almost a decade helping pregnant First Nations women in Adelaide prepare to have a baby. These women would have no idea if their unborn child had been marked for removal by South Australian Child Protection Services.
We weren't informed along the way that they were even thinking about it. Social workers and DCP workers actually entered the delivery room to notify the mother straight after giving birth that the baby was going to be removed.
The women were the subjects of what's called an unborn child concern, sent to the State Department for Child Protection. It's when expectant mothers are accused of being unfit to parent, living in inappropriate housing, or not showing up to prenatal appointments. Mitzi Nam says support workers like her were almost never notified, and the mothers didn't know until after they'd given birth.
The mother's never informed. That's the biggest problem of all. They're just left grieving. It was a horrible feeling because we were also no longer able to contact the mothers to see how they were, where they were, how they were travelling. They were never referred onto another service after their children were taken. We were never trusted in community again because, mob talk.
Last year, Aboriginal children made up a quarter of all newborn removals in SA, despite making up only 5% of the population. The high rate of Aboriginal child removal is the subject of an inquiry by South Australia's Commissioner for Aboriginal Children and Young People, April Laurie. She's heard horror stories of how mothers have learnt their child has been taken.
Letters left on the hospital bed. They've been encouraged to go out and have a cigarette, only to come back to the hospital to find that their baby has been removed. And there is an insidious behaviour to ensure that mum is last to know.
A preliminary report released last year found one in three Aboriginal children were subject to a concern notice before they were born, compared to one in 33 for non-Aboriginal children.
This steep, spiralling, out-of-control Aboriginal child removals is akin to the figures we know throughout the stolen generations. We're talking about issues that are preventable and that removal should be the last resort, but as often as we know by the data, is the first resort.
She says the mothers and families must be told they're facing a concern notice and given a chance to find an alternative to removal.
Family group conferencing needs to be mandatory for every Aboriginal child where there is departmental intervention. Being informed, being involved, and families managing the decision yields much better outcomes for the child.
the Department for Child Protection has acknowledged evidence that mothers are given no notice about a removal. During a public hearing last November, Deputy Chief Executive Adam Riley says it's traumatising families.
All I can say is that I will always defend the work of our staff, but I'll never defend the indefensible. And what you've described, I can't find a rational response to support that action. I would genuinely apologise to those families for that experience. It's unacceptable.
The department says it's now providing family group conferences to address unborn child concerns. However, they are not mandatory. The commissioner will hand down her final report into the removal of First Nations children in SA later this year.
Angus Randall and Stephanie Richards. The tax office is chasing more than $34 billion worth of debts owed by small businesses and self-employed Australians that were put on hold during COVID. But there's concern that the ATO is using aggressive enforcement action to collect the money, which experts say is sending some businesses to the wall. ABC Business reporter Nassim Kadem has the story. We spoke earlier.
The ATO is chasing $34 billion worth of debt that's owed by small businesses. Now, they include a big cohort of people in that definition. It includes sole traders, companies, trusts, partnerships that operate a business for all or part of the income year and have less than $10 million of aggregated turnover. So it can include micro businesses and those operating in the gig economy. So they're saying that $34 billion of $52 billion worth of debt is owed by small business. Now, this is roughly double the more than $26 billion owed pre-COVID. And the ATO is saying, we've resumed these debts during COVID. We now have to resume going back after them, and that paying tax is not optional and will continue to pursue them until they're paid, but that there is help for businesses that genuinely need it.
And why are some people calling this heavy-handed action?
So some people are saying it's very heavy-handed because of the types of powers that the ATO has to go after debts and the types of powers that we're seeing them now use this year to recoup these debts. So some of those actions include that the ATO is reporting tens of thousands of small businesses with debts to credit reporting agencies. They're issuing what's known as garnishee notices, which can result in money being taken directly out of a business owner's bank account. And then they're also initiating wind-up applications in court. So basically, that's a big reason why some companies are going under. Tony Greco is the General Manager of Technical Policy at the Institute of Public Accountants. He fears many small businesses don't have capacity to pay, and more aggressive ATO action could send more businesses under.
We talk about higher cost of living for individuals. The same applies for small business. They're not actually making a lot of money. If the ATO were to pursue this debt aggressively, you'd probably find a lot of small businesses just pretty much hang up their shingles and declare bankruptcy.
That's Tony Greco, the General Manager of Technical Policy at the Institute of Public Accountants. And Nassim, what's the impact of this debt recovery action going to be?
Well, the impact is significant. What we're seeing is a spike in insolvencies this year, and some experts are predicting it's going to hit post-GFC levels. So what we're seeing is that the rate of insolvencies in the past financial year is tracking 36% higher than last year and 25% higher than pre-COVID levels. In the past 4 months alone, they're now 49% higher than last year. Now, in 2012, following the global financial crisis, the number of companies entering insolvency had peaked at almost 11,000. It's a figure that some experts are saying is now likely to be beaten this financial year. And if a company also gets, the ATO is not the only creditor, and some of these are in industries already struggling in a tough economy like construction, hospitality, retail. But if a company gets a notice that the ATO is pursuing them for this kind of debt, that is another factor that basically tips them over.
Business reporter Nassim Kadem. Uber has been operating in Australia now for a decade, and it's hard to remember a time when calling or hailing a taxi was the only alternative. Well, now the rideshare giant has agreed to pay compensation to the taxi industry for upending their business model in Australia. Uber will pay more than $270 million to taxi and hire car drivers who argued they lost income as a result of Uber's arrival. It represents one of the biggest class action settlements in Australian history. Rima Chia reports.
Marie Mears and her husband in Cairns in northern Queensland have dedicated most of their working lives to the taxi industry. But when Uber arrived on Australian shores, it destroyed them financially.
It basically wiped out our superannuation. We didn't just invest. My husband and I collectively have put 80 years into taxi driving, owning, working. And that superannuation is gone because we all worked on the principle we would have our licences there at the end of the day to sell, to fund if we needed nursing care or go into a retirement.
Uber's entry into the local market decimated other taxi licence owners as well. It led Marie to begin advocating for the Queensland state government to intervene.
We live in an area where our licences were to the value of $600,000. Today, in most areas, you're lucky if you can get 20 to 30,000. I've been working on this, trying to get something for the people for the past 7 years. So that's basically been a full-time job as well.
5 years ago, more than 8,000 people banded together to file a class action against Uber. Taxi and hire car drivers, operators and licence holders want compensation for losing income and licence values when the rideshare giant launched in Australia in 2012. Ride-sharing was legalised in 2016, but until then, the class action alleged Uber drivers were operating illegally as they didn't have permits required by state law. Law firm Maurice Blackburn took the case on. The class action principal lawyer is Michael Donnelly.
Today's outcome is an excellent outcome that we are so proud of. Uber has operated to deny our group members justice. They have sought to fight us at every turn, and yet after 5 long years, we stand here today having secured the 5th largest class action settlement in Australian legal history.
Uber has agreed to settle with Maurice Blackburn and pay almost $272 million. Rod Barton, a former MP for Victorian political party Transport Matters, helped bring the case to the law firm 6 years ago.
Well, there's no question now that Uber entered Australia and operated illegally, and I have to say, complicit with the governments, where they knew full well and they did a lot of things that gave them a commercial advantage against the taxi industry, which established their foothold.
Nick Abraham is the CEO of the New South Wales Taxi Council. He says the payout is significant.
It was obviously about compensation for loss of damages, loss of value in licences, loss of income, earnings and revenue during that period that Uber was operating illegally. What about putting a cost to all the stress and anxiety that was caused to many of these people out there just doing the right thing, following the law?
For Rod Barton, this is as much about holding both Uber and state and federal governments accountable.
Make no mistake, we're going to have a talk to the government about their role, and we need to have a look about how do we fix the taxi industry to make sure that we have a taxi industry in 10 years' time.
Former Transport Matters Victorian MP Rod Barton ending that report from Rima Chia. On ABC Radio across Australia, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Victoria's Victims of Crime Commissioner has found that a quarter of victims would not report a crime again. She's found that victims have felt silenced and sidelined by their experiences with the justice system. The commissioner has suggested some victims be provided state-funded legal representation in order to help navigate the system. Oliver Gordon reports.
Victoria's Victims of Crime Commissioner, Fiona McCormack, titled her report into the way the state's justice system treats victims, silenced and sidelined.
Because that's what I heard over and over again.
The commissioner has told ABC Radio Melbourne it's time for a new deal for victims.
I think it's time to challenge the assumptions about what victims can and should put up with when navigating the justice system. I've made 55 recommendations that, if implemented, would provide victims with stronger legal protections, bolster their rights, but also make the process safer and easier for them to participate.
One of the recommendations is a free legal service for victims.
Specialised, free, independent legal advice. There's been 7 inquiries since 2016 in Victoria that have all made that recommendation. You can imagine how many victims they've spoken to in that process. I'm making the same recommendation.
The report also found a quarter of victims would not report a crime again, a reality Commissioner McCormack sees as a failing.
Now, that undermines people's faith in the justice system, and that's why this is really, really important. We need people to report.
Narelle Fraser spent 27 years with Victoria Police, 15 of those years as a detective specialising in sexual assault and child abuse investigations.
The system is unbalanced, and I think we need to level the ledger, and very, very quickly.
She says victims often face traumatising experiences in court.
There's one in particular I had on my podcast recently. That was a woman who actually had to fight to be believed. When she gets to court, she is the one that is cross-examined by her husband in court as the offender. She was so frightened. She was so stressed. This happens all the time. Do we also have a system where the only way that the offender can, let's say, win his case is by his lawyer intimidating and humiliating a victim on the stand?
Professor Kylie Cripps is the chief investigator at Monash University's ARC Centre for Excellence on Violence Against Women. She says many victims of an alleged crime aren't aware of the role they'll play in court.
Often when victims encounter justice systems, whether it's through the police or through the reporting of a crime, they become a witness for the state in that crime. They don't, in and of that experience, get their own independent legal advice. And that becomes problematic because victims don't necessarily then have the transparency or the information that they need to make informed choices about their engagement from that process. They are a witness for the state.
She supports a change to the status quo, which she says is not serving victims.
Many in this report are talking about the court experience being more traumatic than the crime itself. And so taking that to heart, we need to really think about how we're going to support them through this process. And that needs a tailored, more individual approach.
Monash University Professor Kylie Cripps ending that report by Oliver Gordon, and the Victorian government has been contacted for comment. It sounds like an outdated statistic, but sadly it's not. Almost 4 million people have reported being sexually harassed at work in the last 5 years. The National Violence Prevention Organisation Our Watch is launching the Lead the Change initiative today, giving workplace leaders free tools and resources to tackle the issue. Alison Shaw reports.
From an early age, Taylor Perrin wanted to work in the construction industry.
I definitely had a lot of people outside of my family unit warn me that it might not be a good situation to put myself into. It's definitely male dominated. It was then, it still is now.
She says insults and jokes have been thrown at her countless times, and she's experienced sexual harassment at work.
Very early on in my career, I did experience sexual harassment on a work site. I was sort of pressured and pulled into a situation where I felt really uncomfortable.
Almost 4 million Australians have reported being sexually harassed at work in the last 5 years. It led to new regulations coming into force last December, requiring employers to take proactive steps to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace.
We've heard from workplaces that they do want to drive change, they do want to build gender equality, they want to reduce violence against women, but they don't know where to start.
That's Our Watch Chief Executive Paddy Kinnersley. Violence prevention organisation Our Watch is launching a new campaign today that aims to help business leaders tackle the issue.
The aim is for them to be able to access free tools and resources to get the work started. What organisations need to do is to create an environment where women are safe and equal and respected through every part of the organisation. And so they can do things like review their policies and procedures with a gendered lens to make sure that they're not inadvertently discriminating against women through their policies and procedures.
The federal government-funded campaign will focus on businesses in the construction, retail and telecommunications industries. Justine Elliott is the Assistant Minister for the Prevention of Family Violence.
The fact is that everyone deserves to be safe and supported and respected in their workplace, and more broadly for the economy as well, because we know that workplace sexual harassment costs our economy $3.8 billion due to lost productivity, absenteeism and staff turnover.
One of the other key elements of the campaign is to encourage businesses to audit the gender pay gap. Prabha Nandagopal is a leading human rights and discrimination lawyer and founder of Elevate Consulting. She says resources from organisations like Our Watch are going to be invaluable, especially for small businesses.
98% of businesses in Australia are small businesses, and they're not going to have deep pockets to be able to do this. So having free resources out there, free tools, free templates, it's going to be vital.
Ms. Nandagopal says it's also important for businesses to reflect about diversity at the leadership level.
Improving gender equality at very senior leadership levels is going to promote gender equality and, again, tackle one of the key drivers of sexual harassment.
Taylor Perrin has now spent almost a decade in the construction sector as a project engineer and is now in a leadership role. She says support from her colleagues helped her early in her career, and now she wants to help other women by influencing change in her industry.
For me, the main reason I have pushed through and am such an advocate for women in construction and for standing my ground is that I feel like we deserve a place here as much as anyone else.
Construction engineer Taylor Perrin, ending that report by Alison Shao. After 2 years of fiery debate in Queensland, a review has suggested the highly contentious redevelopment of the Gabba be quashed. The plan was to rebuild Brisbane's iconic stadium, but that meant bulldozing a couple of schools and parks. The review is recommending a brand new stadium be built at another inner city location, but that's not without dispute either. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
For the past 2 years, the future of East Brisbane State School has been in doubt. It's been an anxious time for these parents.
Not knowing and trying to plan for the future is hard.
The proposed redevelopment of the Gabba meant the school would be demolished as part of a major infrastructure overhaul ahead of the 2032 Olympics. But a 60-day review has recommended that plan be abandoned, sparking hope for parents like Karen.
Hopefully we can save our school and stay here and be walking distance and riding and everything that we usually do on a daily basis.
Former Lord Mayor of Brisbane, Graham Quirk, was appointed by the state government to lead the Olympics venues review. Instead of the Gabba redevelopment, it recommends building a new 55,000-seat stadium at Victoria Park at a cost of $3.4 billion, more expensive than the original plan.
You have to remember that that Gabba quote of $2.7 billion originally was cast in February of 2023. Now, escalation and building costs have been such that now you're now looking at around $3 billion for that, plus you've got the dislocation costs, compensation for AFL and cricket, which would range between around $185 million and $360 million. So when you add those factors in, you're in the same ballpark.
He says the recommendations are about more than just the Olympics.
What we have recommended will have a life either before or after the Games. Games are a couple of weeks. This is about building what is needed and a legacy for the people of Queensland.
Andrew Chapman is the CEO of the Queensland Major Contractors Association.
We've dilly-dallied around for the last 2 years, 2.5 years. We need to get on with it. To build these kind of facilities, it takes a fair bit of time.
He says the build will take around 4 years. With only 3,048 days until the opening ceremony, worker shortages could pose a challenge.
We do have a worker shortage. However, what we can do is think more smartly about how we build these things, more modularisation and more prefabrication rather than stick building everything.
But not everyone is sold on the idea. Sue Bremner is from the Victoria Park Action Group.
Why is it easier to pour concrete
into a pristine green space than it is to utilise some spaces and some sporting venues perhaps that we already have. Well, the park exists in an already congested residential area with a huge amount of history, I might say.
But Andrew Chapman says there should be plenty of green space left over.
Victoria Park is a very, very big site. Olympic or any kind of stadium that's there would take up a portion of it. It certainly would not take up the lot. And I think having open green space around a stadium gives it, you know, a really good community feel to it. It's going to give, it's going to activate that site a lot better over a longer period of time.
Under the proposal, the Gabba would be utilised until the new stadium is ready to go before being demolished for the site to be repurposed.
Elizabeth Cramsey, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. You can barely buy anything with it, but the price of Bitcoin has hit an all-time high. So how has the cryptocurrency many people wrote off just a few years back bounced back? Today, Andrew Chow, technology correspondent at Time magazine, on the Bitcoin boom. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.